Welcome to Animal Airwaves Live here on WUFTFM. This is our weekly hour-long show devoted to the discussion of the health and welfare of animals. I'm Dana Hill, and I'm very happy to welcome to the program today from the UF College of Veterinary Medicine, Dr. Mauricio Dohovic. And we're going to be talking today about his area of specialty, orthopedic and soft tissue surgery, veterinary surgery, what to expect. We're going to walk you through a procedure pretty much from beginning to end. Animal Airwaves Live is coming up today after this news from NPR. Welcome to Animal Airwaves Live here on Florida's 89.1 WUFTFM, our weekly hour-long show devoted to the discussion of the health and welfare of animals. Today, my guest is Dr. Mauricio Dohovic, and we're going to be talking today about veterinary surgery, what to expect. Welcome to the program, Dr. Dohovic. I want to talk about the background of veterinary surgery. Veterinary surgery is probably kind of a, I don't want to say worst case scenario, but for the most part, if surgery can be avoided, isn't it the truth that you'd want to avoid it?
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for having me, first of all. And to your question, absolutely. My job is to hopefully figure out a way to not do surgery, is how I look at it at first. Because, you know, like you said, surgery is invasive. And no matter what I do, there's always going to be some sort of risk. And certainly, to a large extent, I'd rather not do anything at all if I could avoid it, in the sense of, you know, not causing any additional harm. And that's always a really tough, you know, situation, because a lot of times we're doing surgery in a prophylactic nature, you know, as a preventative nature. And so it's always a situation where the benefits have to outweigh the risks, and it can be a very gray, you know, line.
There are probably instances in which surgery is clearly the best option, right?
Yeah, absolutely. There are certain situations where if we don't do surgery, the patient's going to pass away. There's other situations where if we don't do surgery, the patient may never walk again. And then there's also the situations where, you know, there's just a lump and it's ugly, it's more cosmetic. That being said, sometimes those lumps can be a certain form of cancer, and the sooner we get to it, the better. So it boils down to probably making a really good physical exam and getting the appropriate diagnostics and putting that information together to formulate the best plan. Sometimes things move very, very quickly, and we don't have too much time to decide. For example, a patient that comes in bleeding into their abdomen, and other situations where we just have, you know, a little skin bump, you know, yeah, that can probably, you know, be mulled over a little bit for a few days until we get all our, you know, ducks in a row and decide, okay, is this something that can potentially be aggressive, or is this purely, you know, a cosmetic problem? And do we, you know, really absolutely have to go to surgery?
You might probably see traumas. And traumas, as you mentioned earlier, might involve bleeding into the abdomen. And so in those cases, surgery probably is required.
Absolutely. Yeah, there's, you know, depending what comes through the door, so to speak. You know, we have anything as, you know, straightforward as a fractured leg. That can essentially have a good prognosis with immobilizing with something like a splint or a cast. But it really depends on the nature of the fracture, the patient, the compliance of the patient, you know, the age of the patient. Are they going to be able to heal well? Versus, you know, saying, hey, you know what? Looking at the odds, you know, you're probably not going to heal well. Let's go in there and put a big solid bone plate and put you back together so that we can get you back to normal activity as soon as possible. So that's kind of, you know, one way of of looking at it. There's a lot of factors that come into play, and sometimes finances play a role, and the age of the patient or other concurrent abnormalities that may be there that are longstanding. That may help us decide one way or the other. And at the end of the day, it's certainly not just my decision, in my opinion. It's going to be a group decision between me and the owners as far as what we collectively think is the best. I think, for me, I can give you the options and tell you, these are the five things we could potentially do, but it's up to them to kind of hopefully, me being a good guide to decide what is the best thing for their situation, whether it's going, for example, I get patients that come in to see me because they have bad hips. And so there's a few ways we can treat those hips. Everybody seems to have heard about hip dysplasia. And treatment for that can vary anywhere from just giving, pain medications and keeping them rested and light exercise so they don't aggravate themselves, all the way to a total hip replacement. And there's a few surgeries in between there. And so kind of the Ferrari of it all is the total hip replacement. But it's also the most expensive option. And it's also an option that if there's a complication, typically requires additional surgery. So from a biomechanical standpoint, I think that's the best thing we can do, and that's going to get them back to 100%. But, it's also important for the owners to understand that it's going to carry a risk. It's small, and by all means, we still say, hey, if you want the best, activity possible, let's do a total hip replacement, just like, humans get hip replacements, and they're, looking to get a better quality of life. But over time, these things have the potential to come up with a problem, and it can be hard pill to swallow for some people, and it's the hardest thing when all we're doing is trying to help, and it can backfire, And so that's the tough part. The good thing is that overall, we win more than we lose. Otherwise, we wouldn't be doing it. But it's still, it really is a hard thing for the surgeon. And also the owners to try to help and have it not go our way.
What about some of the other surgeries that you might do either orthopedic or soft tissue, some that are fairly common that you might see on a weekly basis?
Yeah, something, since I kind of brushed on hip dysplasia, there's a lot of other congenital conditions that will come our way, and it affects small dogs and big dogs. Cats tend to be a little bit luckier. I say they don't tend to go under the knife as often, I would say. But as far as other conditions, brachycephalic syndrome is a pretty common one that we'll see, and that's a condition, usually a small breed dogs, the dogs that kind of have a squashed face, like a pug is a perfect example, or a Boston Terrier. Those guys tend to have, so that nose, which is really smashed in, and the rest of their body sort of tries to grow. And as a result, they have, body parts that are kind of in the way of breathing, or they don't have nostrils that are large enough to bring in enough air. And so they'll be chronically hypoxic or chronically without enough oxygen. And they'll also be heavy breathers, snorers. They can have trouble with exercise intolerance. And so those guys usually, they'll come in 6 months to a year of age, and we'll say, your dog definitely has problems breathing. And as a result, they even have developed what's called everted laryngeal saccules, which is something that we can diagnose once they're sedated and we do a good oral exam. And that's a kind of telltale sign that there's just too much airway resistance, and some sort of intervention is beneficial. And so that's another example that we see very, very commonly. Probably the most common orthopedic problem we see is knee problems, actually ACL tears. And in dogs, we call it the cranial cruciate ligament. And humans, they call it the anterior cruciate ligament. But it's the same structure. And it is by far the most common orthopedic condition we see. And, when you think about it, is it absolutely necessary to do knee surgery on anybody? It's not, it's definitely not. It's not going to kill us if we don't do surgery, but it's probably going to hurt a lot to walk around. And so there are, you know, so that's kind of the, you know, the extreme, you know, it's no, I don't necessarily have to do the surgery, but boy, I think I can make you feel a lot better, you know.
Can you tell us a little bit what performing a procedure like that would be like? When you do this, you probably start with an exam to determine whether or not really this is the problem in the first place.
Yeah, absolutely. So usually I'm kind of lucky in the sense that since I am a specialist, a lot of times the problem has already been diagnosed for me. So I have a good idea of what leg hurts and that there's, you know, a problem. Sometimes I have some x-rays I could use, but a lot of times I have a good suspicion. But the typical history of a dog that has an ACL tear is usually they are, you know, active dogs, could be any size, any age, but usually at least a year of age. And the owners noticed that they were limping, but then they improved, and then they started limping again, then they improved, maybe went to the vet gave them some pain meds, went away, and now it's flared back up, and now the dog's completely, you know, limping all the time. And that's kind of a pretty typical history where it's a back and forth. And the reason for that is because when the ACL begins to tear, you start getting inflammation. And the inflammation causes joint fluid to build up, and that pressure is pretty painful. And what can happen is with a little bit of rest, you know, that inflammation goes down, things quiet down, then you're okay for a little while, but then you get a little bit more ripping, you know. And the common misconception is that when the ripping begins, you know, is if we keep them quiet, that we can still get them to heal. And to date, nobody's been able to achieve that. You know, unfortunately, the ACL has really poor blood supply. And so that's one of the main reasons why once there's a little bit of a tear, it's just not going to heal. And so it's sort of a matter of time before it turns into a complete tear. So a lot of people will ask me, you know, say, hey, well, if it's just a partial tear, can I avoid surgery? And I usually say, well, probably not. It's going to become a complete tear. And all you're doing is kind of, you know, prolonging the discomfort. And you're also promoting any permanent degenerative changes that that occur as a result of the inflammation, which always happens. So they'll come in to see me. And, you know, we confirm the diagnosis. Usually we can do that just on manipulation. And honestly, it takes quite a bit of practice to be really good at manipulating those knees and getting a good feel for whether there's a torn cruciate or not. But we can't always tell, because if there is, only a partial tear, we might not detect that instability. So usually what we'll do is we'll also take a set of x-rays. Under sedation, and they're very specific x-rays when I take them, because usually I use those same set of x-rays so I can do any preoperative planning. So even if patients have already come with some x-rays, I usually end up having to take another set that allow me to plan for surgery. So those x-rays, what I'm looking for is, it turns out you actually can't see the ACL on x-rays. So it's a great question when people, you know, are a little bit familiar and say, well, why are you taking x-rays if you can't see the ACL? Well, what I'm actually looking for is all the secondary changes that occur when there's an ACL injury. Mm. And so we're pretty lucky with dogs that not too many things cause secondary changes to the knee. There's just a handful. You know,
Can you describe what some of these secondary changes would look like?
Absolutely.
And why they would come about?
Yeah, and the secondary changes are essentially arthritis and osteoarthritis, and it's going to come about as bony proliferation in certain points of the knee. You know, you might see some right at the very tip of the patella. You might see some on the side of the condyles or the bone of the knee. And then the other thing we look for is also evidence of a lot of effusion. And we see that by displacement there's a little fat pad in the knee, and we can see that get pushed over, and we say, oh, wow, there's got to be a ton of effusion there, or joint fluid. And all those things kind of put together along with our exam, then you can be very, very confident, you know, even if you didn't have instability, that you probably have an ACL tear. If you're still not convinced you have an ACL tear, in humans, you know, the kind of standard of care is to get an MRI. We're not there with dogs. Big reason is that it's just really expensive because we have to anesthetize these guys to get an MRI. And so since, you know, 98% of the time we could make the diagnosis with, and I'm just making up that percentage, but the majority of the time we can make the diagnosis on our physical exam in conjunction with our radiographs, you know, we're pretty lucky in that there's really not much going on. Occasionally when there's curveballs, you know, we'll say, hey, I might want to do a joint tap to make sure the joint fluid's consistent with an ACL tear and nothing like an infection, for example, or an immune-mediated condition. Otherwise, we'll go ahead and push forward and say, okay, these are our options for surgery. A lot of times also, the surgeon might want to do arthroscopy also, which is to stick a camera into the knee joint so they can visualize that that ACL and sort of confirm and treat the condition at the same time.
In a situation where the pet has this, what did you call it, a cranial cruciate ligament, would you be able to see in the pet as you manipulate this limb that the pet is uncomfortable?
Yeah, great question. So there's actually, you know, aside from evaluating the entire patient, when I focus on the knee specifically looking for an ACL tear, there's a few things I'm looking for. I'm looking for what's called cranial drawer, and that's the kind of shifting back and forth of the knee bones, the tibia and the femur. There's really certain points where we grab them from and essentially try to make them move. And we're not, you know, if there's a ligament there, it's not going to move. There's another test that we do called tibial thrust. And it's also designed to test the integrity of the cruciate ligament. And the final test that we do is also extending the knee. And so What the cruciate ligament, the cranial one, because there's actually two in there. There's a caudal one as well, which sits behind the cranial one. And what the role of the cruciate ligament is to prevent excessive extension, prevent that drawer motion that I'm describing, and prevent excessive internal rotation. And so if those three are gone, you know, or if the cruciate's gone, then those three, you know, are going to be pretty sloppy, essentially. Now, the catch is, though, if the dog is very stressed out and very strong, you know, you can contract your muscles and make it very difficult for me to actually do those tests. And that's why sometimes under sedation, it's a lot easier. Well, always under sedation, it's a lot easier to feel. And so your vet might say, hey, I want to sedate. And it also makes it less stressful for them when we do the x-rays. So it's very common for us to do that. The main thing is the only time I'm causing any distress is probably going to be on extension. The extension, typically, we get pain. And the way we look for pain is actually I go to the point where, you know, immediately they'll either just, you feel them kind of contract their leg, you know, saying, hey, that hurt. Sometimes you could see it in their eyes where they're just kind of sitting relaxed and all of a sudden they open them up. And they got this look on their face, or they turn around and look at you. So there's a few things that you can do. Usually, anytime I do an extension test, I'm always looking at the head, because that's where I'm going to see, you know, the kind of the facial expression change. And then with my hands, I can feel if the leg's tensing up and if they're drawing it away because it hurt. Mm. And so it's a very subtle move, but it's, you know, I think people who are attuned with their pets can immediately notice when I elicit pain, just like when I do it, you know, I can pretty much tell. And so those are the things that that we'll do for the ACL.
You're listening to Animal Airwaves Live here on WUFTFM. I'm Dana Hill speaking with Dr. Mauricio Dohovich, and we're talking today about veterinary surgery. And we're going to get back to the idea of what to expect with a surgical procedure for your pet. But right now we're kind of talking, interestingly enough, about the ACL. And this is a condition that you say you see on a semi-regular basis?
Yeah, absolutely. Super regular. We see, this is probably the most common condition that we see from an orthopedic standpoint by far. Dogs, you know, one of the downsides, obviously good for the orthopedic surgeon, but one of the downsides for dogs is that they are there's a good subset of dogs that seem to be genetically predisposed to tear their ACL or their cranial cruciate ligament, same thing. And those guys, that's the devastating side about it is that if they tear one side, there's probably a 40 to 50% chance that they're going to tear the other side. And most of these dogs, you know, they tend to be, you know, normal, healthy dogs. There's really no indicator or nothing that that I can say, you know, hey, you've been raising your dog inappropriately. You should have never let them do this. And that's a very common question I get is, hey, what did I do wrong? You know, could I have done anything differently? And the thing I could, you know, the only thing I could recommend is make sure your dog's not overweight. Make sure your dog gets regular, you know, low impact exercise. So nothing too crazy. But at the same time, you know, they're one of the reasons we love to have them around is because it's fun to watch them play, and it's hard to keep them in a bubble. You know, so those are the biggest things. There is a genetic component, unfortunately, and at this point, it's not really known how to trace it per se, and be able to guarantee that you're gonna purchase a dog that's never gonna have an ACL tear. So if they get it, they get it. And it's just something that you know owners have to sort of roll with the punches.
Mm-hmm. Now, the process of performing the surgery is going to involve anesthesia, correct?
Yes.
Could you sort of guide us, even step by step, if you can, through the process? Because this might hold true for a variety of surgical procedures, not just for this particular condition.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a lot of things that we'll do kind of to make sure the patient is stable for anesthesia and healthy enough for anesthesia. Certainly for what we call an elective orthopedic procedure like this one, patients are usually otherwise healthy, but usually we'll get blood work, do what's called a complete blood count and a chemistry panel to make sure that there's no surprises, that their electrolytes are okay, that their liver's doing okay, their kidneys are functioning okay, that there's no raging systemic infection, you know, that is unaccounted for. So just as a baseline, and, you know, a lot of these patients that come in, they don't get annual checkups and they haven't had blood work recently. It really makes the anesthesiologist happy to know that their patient is going to be, you know, a routine anesthetic candidate and that they don't have to take any special precautions. When the patient is older or has a history of, you know, heart disease, then we might escalate things a little bit. Those patients might get a set of chest x-rays kind of as a baseline to make sure that the heart's normal in size and that we don't need to kind of investigate that any further. Chest x-rays also are a very good screen for cancer. Anytime the patient has cancer, there's going to be a chance it could spread to the chest. And so sadly, if ever we see any nodules in the lung fields, for example, then usually it's a situation where we say, yeah, I don't think we should do surgery anymore. Go home and, you know, spoil your dog, because unfortunately, whatever it is that's going on, you know, knee surgery is not, you know, not the important thing right now. And that's very, very, very rare for us to find that. But occasionally, you know, there's certain things that, you know, happen throughout the exam or in talking to the owners that may, you know, give us the hunch that, you know what, maybe we should take x-rays for this patient, or this guy's pretty old, or this guy has a history of previous cancer. Maybe let's check the x-rays. Or if, for example, the patient has chronic problems with aspiration pneumonia, we might take a set of chest x-rays to make sure we are going into it healthy and we have something good to compare with in case we have any hiccups along the way. And then once that's taken care of, and we have our preoperative x-rays, then at that point, the patient is ready to go to anesthesia. Here at the university, we're pretty lucky that we have a, you know, complete anesthetic team with boarded anesthesiologists and a really, you know, brilliant team. And what they do is once we submit the request and they have the patient, they'll go ahead and repeat the exam, you know, with a special focus on, you know, is this patient, and not necessarily does this patient have a bad knee, but is this patient stable for anesthesia? And they'll go ahead and also review the blood work and whatnot and make additional recommendations as necessary if they feel, you know, something else should be done prior to. As long as they're happy and we're happy, then we go ahead and move forward with anesthesia. A lot of the times, the patients are kind of come back the next day for surgery or a few days later when they're scheduled, depending on what's going on. And the main reason for that is, one, there's a whole bunch of other patients undergoing anesthesia, but also to make sure that the patient is fasted. We like to have all patients fasted. There is actually a pretty high rate of passive food or stomach contents going up into the esophagus when anesthetized. And that's one of the reasons we put a tube inside the windpipe or the trachea at the time of surgery to essentially create a seal so that none of the stuff from the stomach goes into the windpipe so we don't get pneumonia. We'll go ahead and have them fasted so that minimizes the chances. So anytime your dog gets surgery or even sedated, it's nice to have them fasted for at least 8 hours or so. That goes for adult puppies. You know, they're growing. They can't regulate their blood sugar. That's a completely separate issue. But for the average dog, you know, usually we'll try to have them fasted. Usually we'll say no food after 10 p.m. You can have as much water as you want. Come in, the morning of surgery, and that'll be at least hopefully 8 hours of at least a solid 8 hours of making sure that stomach's empty so that we can minimize any chance of complications as a result of anesthesia.
You're listening to Animal Airwaves Live here on WUFTFM. I'm Dana Hill speaking with Dr. Mauricio Dohowicz, and we're talking about veterinary surgery, what to expect. We're going to take a short break. We'll be back right after this. Welcome back to Animal Airwaves Live here on WUFTFM. This is our weekly hour-long show devoted to the discussion of the health and welfare of animals. I'm Dana Hill, and I'm joined today by Dr. Mauricio Dohowicz from the UF College of Veterinary Medicine. We're talking today about veterinary surgery, what to expect, and when we left off, we were just about to go into surgery for an ACL procedure or a cranial cruciate ligament, I believe Dr. Dohowicz called it. And doctor, when we left off, we had just done anesthesia, right? So you are receiving this animal patient that is already anesthetized, right? That means this patient is basically immobilized, is unconscious, but is healthy enough for surgery, let's say. If you've gotten this far, you're pretty much good to go, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And there's and it doesn't stop at just doing the blood work and deeming them healthy for anesthesia. Immediately, as soon as that induction agent, if you will, goes into their veins, and even before, they are already being monitored. We already have them instrumented so that we can see what the heart is doing, so we can see how well the blood is being oxygenated. And you know, it's really fun and amazing that many of the same technologies that you see in the human side, we are able to apply them to animals now. You know, some of them not as fancy because it's cost prohibitive, if we get good donors, maybe we can change that. By and large, it's pretty it's pretty well mirrored. A lot of the stuff is really basic, and it's really easy to monitor. So we're looking at blood pressure. We're looking both in minimally invasive way or invasive blood pressure, and also non-invasive blood pressure. We're looking ECG. So that's the electrical rhythm of the heart. We have machines that can count respirations for us. We have machines that can ventilate for the patient for us. So there's just a tremendous amount of things that go into anesthesia, and essentially a small little army of people mobilizing to make sure that everything's done to the highest quality and to the most efficient extent possible. And one of the things that a lot of people don't discuss, though, is, you know, before we anesthetize a patient, we always ask the owners, if your pet were to pass away, would you like us to do CPR? And that's, it always throws, owners, it side rails everybody. I hate asking that question because I don't want anything to happen. But it's something that, it's a sort of this routine for any patient being anesthetized in the hospital gets that question asked because, yes, there is a risk to anesthesia. It's less than 1%, but it's there, And so if something were to go terribly wrong, we sort of need to know what are the wishes of the owners. And so if you guys are ever at the vet and your vet asks you that, don't assume it's because they expect something to go bad. I guess that's the main reason I'm saying it. It's just, to have us better prepared so we can get things moving if you'd like us to keep moving. Back to the anesthesia part of it. Immediately the patient is being, attended to from the anesthetic standpoint, but also from the standpoint of preparing them to go into the operating room, and that's shaving. All of our pets, for the most part, have a lot of fur, and so there's going to be a lot of shaving to prepare that site and make it nice, clean, and sterile, so we don't get an infection. And then once all that's done, which can take quite a while depending on the area, but can take upwards to a half hour to an hour, which is something also that, people don't kind of account into it. But yeah, besides the, a surgery that might take me 45 minutes can sometimes take an hour to prep to get the surgery, which is sort of counterintuitive. And the beautiful thing about it is, we're really good at anesthesia now and monitoring patients and keeping them stable. It's not unheard of to go for, surgeries that take as long as 6 hours, and it typically doesn't really raise any, alarm flags per se, if a patient's under for that long, because I know we can do it on a consistent, regular basis and keep them stable and not put them at any danger. And the nice thing is we can really do some pretty complex procedures that in the past we would have been concerned about, having them under anesthesia for that long. But nowadays things are fortunately that good for us that we can do some pretty neat things if necessary that might take a little bit longer. For the most part, I'd say the average surgery usually takes the surgeon anywhere from half hour to an hour and a half. I'd say that's probably run-of-the-mill for most surgeries, but there are those that can take a lot longer, depending what you find.
And how much time does the anesthesia give you? I imagine maybe that is determined by how much you tell the anesthesiologist you need.
Yeah, great question. So usually what we do is when we anesthetize an animal, we first give them an anesthetic through the vein. That's, I'd say, 90-something percent of the time, a good chunk of the time, that's the easiest way to do it. They all have catheters so that we can give them other drugs as necessary. So if their heart rate's slow, we can give them medications to speed up their heart rate. If their blood pressure's low, we can give them medication. So every patient is going to have some sort of what we call intravenous access, which is access to one of the veins. And through that, we give them the induction agent. And for example, if you remember, I guess, unfortunately, Michael Jackson, propofol, that's a very, very common induction agent that's used in humans and in dogs and cats. So we'll give them what's called an ultra short acting anesthetic agent, and it's injectable. And with that, that'll give us enough a window of time to be able to put in what's called the endotracheal tube, or the tube that's going to go in their windpipe. And then from there, we transition them to a gas anesthetic. And the nice thing is this gas anesthetic, I mean, we have enough to last us days. Obviously, you're not going to keep a patient anesthetized for days, but it's a system where they just breathe in this gas and it keeps them asleep. And we can refill the gas as necessary while the patient's even anesthetized. It's not a problem at all. And so so I guess to answer your question, we can keep the patient anesthetized for an indeterminate period of time. Obviously, all anesthetics, you know, are going to be detrimental at eventual dose. You know, eventually the patient will begin to decompensate with any drug when given in excess. But we can keep them really safe for hours on end, if need be. But the procedure, as far as when it's done, it's essentially done whenever the surgeon finishes, and the anesthetist is always polite enough to not rush us.
Now, I want to remind people, of course, you're listening to Animal Airwaves live here on WUFT. I'm Dana Hill speaking with Dr. Mauricio Dohovic. And when the anesthesia is set and ready to go, the bed has been prepped, you've got a pretty clear, shaved area in which to begin operating. Tell us about some of your tools.
Yeah, the tools is probably one of the funnest parts of it for me. There's a lot of power tools for orthopedic surgery, and makes it really fun. I know some people are probably cringing, but it's a really really exciting thing for me to be able to use all these different instruments and kind of maximize or optimize my ability to do as good a job as possible. And it can really vary, you know. It could be tools that are designed to just kind of move things out of the way for you, all the way to tools that are designed to drill through bone, tools that are designed to make you more accurate. And certain surgeries will even use, you know, these guys can be very small, and we'll use an operating microscope. And a lot of times we even wear what's called surgical loops. Where we get some extra magnification so that we can see better what we're doing. More and more also, we're doing what's called laparoscopic or thoracoscopic surgery. And those are surgeries where we go in and just like in humans, we'll put in a little camera and through a little incision and actually do a couple other small incisions so we can get small little instruments and try to keep the incision as small as possible so that hopefully we create as little discomfort as possible. So the tools, you know, they range from, you know, your classic scalpel handle that's been around for probably centuries, all the way to really, really, really sophisticated tools that are expensive, you know, tens of thousands of dollars, that are designed to maybe cauterize and coagulate vessels and also allow us to achieve a very high degree of magnification and accuracy. So it really varies dramatically. There's also a lot of different what we call implant sets or tools that are designed for certain types of fractures. There's different types of bone plates, you know, and for example, if we're doing a total hip replacement, that whole procedure has its own designated specialized set of tools designed for doing a total hip replacement. So sometimes the surgery demands a very specific set of instruments. Many surgeries, you know, there's a basic set of instruments that we use, but sometimes it can be very highly specialized.
I want to ask a question that might seem silly, considering it is probably so central to surgeries for animals or humans too, and I feel like I should probably already know this, but let's say you're doing a surgical procedure and you need to sever a blood vessel of some sort, right, in doing the procedure. Is that something that happens?
Oh yeah.
Okay. How do you get them back together again?
So, you know, it's actually, you know, thankfully, most of the time there is enough collateral circulation where if we have to sacrifice a vessel, it's not a big deal. And this is where it's really important for that surgeon to kind of be familiar with the anatomy and be familiar with what they're doing. and sort of have plan A, B, and C in the back of their minds, and be ready with some sort of, you know, I guess, response in case, you know, it hits the fan, so to speak.
Yeah.
And I can, you know, I can give you, you know, there's certainly a lot of examples where I've had to remove tumors where the tumor is just encapsulating a you know, fairly large vessel. And there's nothing we could do but sacrifice that vessel. And same thing happens with nerves. You know, we say, gosh, I really hope this nerve isn't important because it's got to go. And in those situations, you know, we try to prep owners and say, hey, you know, there might be some nerve damage. We just don't know till we do it. And sometimes we have a good idea if we, you know, when we do a CT or an MRI, it might shed some light. But at the end of the day, a lot of times it's, well, we just have to do it and just kind of see what happens to some extent, unfortunately. But most of the time, it's amazing how resilient the body is despite us. Now, there's certain vessels that you certainly don't want to sever. A great example, or if you do, you got to be careful. You know, I recently had a patient where we had a tumor that was invading into what's called the caudal vena cava. And it was an adrenal tumor, a very common tumor that likes to invade into the caudal vena cava. The caudal vena cava is the largest vein that returns all the blood back to the heart. And so if you cut that, the patient will bleed out, you mm-hmm. know, in a matter of seconds. It can be pretty dramatic. And so so it's a very, you know, this particular patient had about 6 or 7 centimeters worth of invasion into that caudal vena cava. So you can imagine there's a tremendous amount of planning that has to go around to be able to successfully remove that. And what you're talking about is for a temporary partial, you know, or complete obstruction of flow, so that we can kind of remove the entire tumor and cut into the vena cava safely, remove the tumor and suture things back up, you know, all before, you know, something bad happens to the patient. And that's where the team is super important. I mean, you know, it's never just one surgeon. And for surgeons, you know, out there that you know, take all the glory, they shouldn't. You know, it's a surgeon's only as good as the people around them. And typically, to be a good surgeon, you have to surround yourself with people that are better than you. And so the anesthetic team is incredibly important. You know, the people that are scrubbed in with you in surgery, it's just super, super important to have them sort of anticipate what you're doing so that you have good communication throughout, so that everything's as efficient and flows as smoothly as possible, so that, you know, we can do everything right and get in and get out. And keep the patient safe. And so for all that to happen, it's not just the anesthetic team, it's the, you know, the surgery team, the people who prep and have the instruments ready, the people who take care of the instruments. If they don't do a good job, the instrument can fail while you're doing something very critical, and that can cause a big disaster. So there's a lot of pieces to the puzzle, and a lot of things that have to come together so that, you know, we're this kind of well-oiled machine. And it's just amazing that that when you have a really good team, it's the funnest thing in the world, and it makes it very cool to be able to, you know, help all these patients.
Now let us assume in this hypothetical surgical procedure we've been talking about that everything has gone just right and you've completed the procedure, you've done some stitches or whatever you do. What do you do to close up a surgical opening like that?
Yeah, you know, it's stitches, honestly. Mm-hmm. It just like any cut, it stitches. The only difference is that it could be multiple layers. You know, there's different layers to get through the skin, through the what we call the subcutaneous fat, then there's fascial tissue. So we might have several layers of skin sutures, and depending on, you know, what I did, most of those skin sutures are going to be absorbable, so we don't have to come back and remove them. A lot of times I make it such that they're actually underneath the skin surface and not showing, so that so the patients won't want to lick at them or chew at them, and it just it looks nicer. So a lot of times I'll do that as well. But at the end of the day, it's just a whole bunch of suture. That's pretty much it. Occasionally, we'll use staples. That's also, you know, acceptable. Can be a little bit quicker. We'll use either staples or sutures. Yeah.
So recovery. This is probably an important aspect of any kind of surgery, and that is what happens afterwards. The animal will have to come out of anesthesia and will then have a period of, I don't know how long it takes before the animal is fully like back on its feet, so to speak.
Yeah, absolutely. The recovery period is very important because we want them to come out of the anesthesia smoothly. You know, we don't want them waking up and being what we call dysphoric and potentially, you know, jumping around, moving around and opening up their incision, for example. So we usually have somebody right there monitoring, kind of ready and able to administer additional medications to bring down any sort of anxiety or bad trip, if you will. It's very uncommon. Usually these guys have a very smooth recovery, but there are, you know, you do enough of these and you'll see some of these guys not necessarily, you know, just kind of wake up and be afraid and try thrashing around. So we just have to, there's good ways of calming them down, whether it's just kind of being there with them or giving them a anti-anxiety, you know, injection, that sort of stuff. Or if they're painful, then give them pain medication. So a lot of it is going to be, you know, what is the patient telling us that they need, and addressing that and sort of meeting them halfway. And giving them whatever it is that they're asking for, whether it's pain medications or just anxiety medications or just something as simple of, hey, you know, I haven't peed since surgery, I need to go pee. So those are the things that we'll look for. Usually with any surgery that I end up doing, it's typically more painful than your average surgery. And you can expect most of my patients to stay at least a night in the hospital with injectable pain medications to make sure they're comfortable. And then we slowly transition them to oral medications and see if they're still comfortable. And then at that point, if all else is okay, hopefully they're also starting to eat a little bit or drink a little bit. And then they sort of earn themselves a trip home, you know. But the biggest thing is, you know, I really don't like rushing them out of the hospital. But it's hard because some patients, you know, they're not going to eat at the hospital. They're just too stressed out, you know. Cats specifically, you know, they are typically, you know, pretty afraid of a new environment and are just not going to eat till they get home, you know. And so that's something that, you know, you kind of have to take with a grain of salt and communicate with the owners and say, hey, you know, your pet, do you think he's going to eat, or is he the kind of pet that's going to be so stressed out that he's not going to eat? Okay, well, if you feel certain he's not going to eat, then why don't we send him home, because that's the only reason he's here. He's otherwise comfortable. Let's send him home and let's just stay in touch and let me know if he's eating, you know, so I can sleep well. So we'll do that quite often.
Will you need to see the patient again for a follow-up?
Yeah, most of the time, yeah, actually pretty much all the time. For most incisions, it takes about 2 weeks for them to heal, 10 to 14 days. And so most of my first rechecks will be at 10 to 14 days. If I did orthopedic surgery where there's some sort of fracture or bone cut or anything like that, then I'm probably going to see them at about the 8-week mark as well. Might see them sooner depending on what's going on if I want to track things a little bit closely. But most bone, it takes about 8 weeks to heal in a normal adult dog. And so at that point, usually I'll see them back, take some x-rays, and confirm that, you know, our surgery site is essentially healed, whatever that fracture might have been and whatnot. And in the meantime, you know, the owners will have pretty specific set of instructions on what to do and what to expect. And you know, it's a open door policy in the sense of if you feel something's wrong, come in sooner before it gets worse, you know.
So overall, surgery, something not to be hoped for, but if necessary, not something to be unduly afraid of, and certainly not something to put off if one can give a pet a better quality of life, would you say?
Yeah, I agree. You know, I totally agree. I mean, there's so many ways we can make a difference, and certainly not every surgery is it may be right for every pet, but you know, it's at the end of the day we're doing a lot of good and saving a lot of lives through surgery. And it's just a huge privilege that I could be a part of this thing. It's super fun, and it's very nice to see, you know, animals up and about again, and walking. Whether we did, you know, spinal surgery or fracture repair, or they were bleeding out for some reason or had some really bad cancer, it's great to, you know, get them back to their owners, back to normal, and have them go be their silly, goofy selves. And get back to it. It's just, you know, the only problem with dogs is and cats is they just don't live long enough. But other than that, there's no reason why we shouldn't fix them.
Well, Dr. Mauricio Duhovich from the UF College of Veterinary Medicine, thank you so much for coming in and talking to us today.
Thanks for having me.